Good morning, and welcome to our Ag in Uncertain Times webinar, today focusing on operating in risky environments. And thank you for your patience. We've solved our technical issue. And I'm John Newkirk. I'm with Washington State University's Western Center for Risk Management Education. And I'll operate as the MC. And our Ag in Uncertain Times webinar series is designed around providing useful information and helping producers and others meet the challenge of today's uncertain economy. And today's discussion is about ag's future and an introduction to strategic risk management. And if you're interested in our past webinars, they're all archived. Give you a reference to that in the future. So today we're really pleased to have Gary Brester with us from Montana State University. I'll give him a little further explanation in just a minute, and then followed by John Hewlett from the University of Wyoming. And there will be an opportunity to present questions to each of them after their presentations, and then following both presentations, we'll bring Gary back on so that we can ask them both questions. To enter questions, you enter them into the chat window over here at the side, and you type into the smaller window. When you're done typing, click that return arrow there, and it gets sent to us here, and we've got a team working behind the scenes who then, if we get the same question from several people, they'll wrap it into one, but they'll present it to me, and then I will give the question back to the presenters. As I mentioned just briefly earlier, we have a link to past webinars. And we'll give you this web address later in the program again, so you don't have to quickly write it down. And our June, September, and October series are all archived there for you to use. Next week, as a follow-up to this, today's focus is around where are we. Next week, how do we get there? We're going to do a review of some strategic risk management curriculum and tools and have a great team. And then on the 18th of November, we're going to review some of the resources that are out there through the Regional Extension Risk Management Centers. Another resource is the eExtension MITNet, extension.org, where there is also a wealth of other resources not around farm for farm and ranch families, community, individuals, and families. That's real simple. Actually, you can just Google MITNet, and that'll get you to that. If you simply want to see the full screen slides, if you're having trouble seeing them, you toggle on full screen, and you can toggle in and out. If you toggle that, you won't see the chat box here on the left and be able then to submit your questions. So you have to toggle back out of full screen to be able to enter your question. Let's go right to Gary. Gary is a professor in the Department of Agricultural Economics and Economics at Montana State University. He was raised on an irrigated sugar beet and multi-quality farm near Laurel, Montana. And he has 2 degrees from Montana State and then finished his PhD in economics from North Carolina State University. His teaching responsibilities include farm and ranch management, agribusiness management, finance, agriculture marketing, and his applied research program includes livestock and grain, risk management, international trade, agribusiness, and farm management issues. He's currently managing editor of the Journal of Agriculture and Resource Economics and is sought out as a speaker on the topic that we're talking about today, and so we're really pleased to have Gary with us. And so, Gary, the program is yours. I'll be back when you're finished with a few questions for you. So thank you for joining us, Gary, and go right ahead.
Thank you very much, John. That was a very kind introduction, and I appreciate the opportunity to address this group. I've been reviewing materials that's been presented so far, and I'm quite impressed with the quality of presenters and the breadth of the conversations that have occurred to date. And when Duane asked me to do this talk, I happen to be working on a couple other talks. In fact, as soon as I'm done with this webinar, I head into Western Montana, which from here is a 5 or 6 hour drive, and be talking about some of these things to some producers on the western side of our state. One of the things that Duane asked me to do was give some thought to comments that were made a few months ago by David Cole, and maybe follow up a little bit with my perspective regarding the future for U.S. agriculture, and hence my title. There's always a future. The question is this a dim or a bright future? So with that, I will be referring back to some of the comments that David made, and again, who put out a very nice introduction to your entire series. And I will probably occasionally make fun of John Hewlett as well, just because that's something that I'm supposed to do on occasion. So as a quick outline, I'd like to talk a little bit about this concept of change. I know so much of the discussions that are occurring in the Ag in Uncertain Times curriculum is talking about, we often hear the word unprecedented change or previously unheard of volatility and things like that. So I want to talk a little bit about changing agriculture. Talk about a real success story, and that is one of agricultural productivity. One of the things I do, increasingly that I do when I have presentations in the state to producers, is try to show them some things that they probably don't see because they don't have the time, or in many cases they don't have the fun that I do looking at data. And so for many of the extension educators who are like me, we look at lots of data, and hopefully we get a picture that we can present to people that they don't have not seen in the past. Talk a little bit about recent commodity price behavior and a little bit about some things that I teach at Montana State dealing with strategic business management, a topic that often is not considered in the context of production agriculture, and a topic which I think must be considered as we talk about the future of agriculture. And it, just in a nutshell, some of the things that I keep track of and add to my list of changes that appear to be occurring in the food and fiber sector. And again, none of these changes have never occurred in the past. It's just they seem to occur pretty quickly and maybe more broadly than what we've seen in the past in production agriculture. I mean, think back to people that were raising grains prior to World War I. If they were on a farm today, they wouldn't have any idea how to produce a bushel of wheat. And so we've always had change. Maybe it's more rapid now, maybe not. But some of the things that have contributed to that has been really, really trade liberalization, and most of all of this has come about because of information technology. The technologies that John introduced me with and the technology that didn't work in my office is working in Duane's office, and it's working in many others. And all of these have contributed to, I think, advanced changes or advancing speed of changes. So certainly biotechnology, changing government roles throughout the world, have had an influence on how fast the food and fiber sector has changed. And when I talk to a lot of producers, you often hear the following. I hate change. I want things to stay the way they are or the way they were. Pick your decade that a person felt like things were better. I'm always reminded of my mother, who grew up dirt poor on a farm. And didn't learn enough from that. She married a farmer and continued to run a pretty good business after that. But she tells me, well, the good old days might have been old, but they weren't all that good. And so whenever we think about change, a lot of change has been for the good. I'm reminded and often refer to comments made by General Eric Shinseki, who was the U.S. Army Chief of Staff in a very early part of this decade. And when he was talking about change, he was referring to military things because he was a great proponent of changes in the military. His quote was, if you don't like change, you're going to like irrelevance even less, because we don't have a choice with change. We either adapt or we get out. And it applied to the Army and to the military just like it applies to most economic issues as well. What has been the drivers of this change quickly? Again, it's been documented by lots of folks, as I mentioned before. General technology, including biotech and information technology. But we shouldn't underestimate transportation technologies and packaging and food processing technology, which allow greatly improves shelf life on a number of commodities, which makes the world a smaller place in terms of producing food, and certainly in the case of fiber. A second primary driver of change has been population and income growth. In developed countries, we generally, even though we're in a recession now, we generally have much higher incomes than we've had in a generation ago, almost double a generation ago. This has put priorities into the areas of food safety and nutrition, convenience, and how things are produced, the processes involved, including processes all the way back to genetic material as far as that goes. Developing countries, again, increasing middle classes have increased demands not only for food in general, but especially for animal source proteins. So another driver of change. Trade and government involvement in agriculture, I'm lumping these together. Economies, especially developed economies, have found what developing economies have always known. Protectionism is expensive. New Zealand and Australia were one of the first groups to say we can't afford to do as much of this as before. The EU is saying the same thing. Canada and even the U.S. is feeling the bite of protectionism. And even without that, we were going to see increased competitiveness globally because of information technology. There just aren't many secrets out there anymore in terms of what's being produced, where it's being produced, and how much of it is being produced, coupled with transportation technological changes as well. My fourth driver of change that I like to talk to producer about is in the U.S., maybe worldwide, but certainly in the U.S., demographic changes. We now have lots of families with two incomes that tend to have enough wealth to demand more convenience and certain processes in their food. That's new in this past generation. We have single heads of households that lack both wealth and oftentimes they lack time as well, which influences the food sector to a large extent. Something that we tend to overlook, and we shouldn't be, because we hear of the problems of health care and Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, the increasing percentage of the populations that are in that senior category, we often forget that seniors' eating and health habits also change. And as we have a growing group of the population that are seniors, the food and fiber sector will be responding to that as well. And we have some changing demographics with respect to ethnicity, which has some influence on changing food demands as well. What are the implications of this change? Well, I've come up with probably two ways of thinking about what farms and ranches of the future are going to look like. I think there'll be two types. I think we're going to see the traditional commodity producers that are using new technologies, advanced technologies at work. They're going to continue to strive, and I'll talk more about this later, to be low-cost producers. They're going to be thinking about high volumes and low margins. They probably are going to be the bigger producers, and as John Hewlett will be visiting about later, and then I see later on with the strategies in terms of managing risk, these folks are going to have to be very savvy at managing both their price and production risk, which you always have to do in a high-volume, low-margin industry. The other type, I'll just call them generically value-enhanced producers, those that are going to be focusing more on expanding margins. This could be through identity preservation, through the development and sale and production of specialty products, maybe things that will have nutraceutical or certain animal welfare attributes that people are willing to pay for. Some people are willing to pay for perhaps low input, meaning less use of chemicals or organic, something like that. What are these folks going to have in their toolkit to manage that risk? Well, they're going to have very strong marketing and entrepreneurial skills. They're going to have to be good at negotiating, and they're going to have to be good at trying to share risk with others and be very involved in market coordination issues with the people that they have lined up to be part of that particular supply chain. Food systems, then, are restructuring as well, and they've been doing this for a long time. A little bit less reliance on commodity markets as we look for specificity in terms of how things are produced probably means increased contracting. And one of the side effects of this appears to be some higher concentration in the food processing sector or in the logistics sector, any of those sorts of things. And I think we have to think about that when you have that higher concentration, there's going to be lots of concern about whether or not this is generating market power, which what we really mean is negotiating power. Are we providing more ability or will concentrated processors have the ability to negotiate more severely with providers or not? But we also know, and plenty of our research has shown, that there is also efficiencies for much of the concentrated industries, and that we have trade-offs between these two issues. It probably means for many producers less independence and doing things just the way they want, more concern about the process and keeping track of and identifying whether it's cattle ID, whether it's process-oriented identification. We're going to see more of that. Probably some chance for more risk sharing amongst adjacent sectors. And then we always have the issue of who's in control when we have that linkage between production and the processing sector. I have a question mark behind that because we often don't know, and it's often specific to the particular situation. So after all of this restructuring and all the changes we've got going on, what does the ownership of farms look like in the U.S.? This is from the U.S. 2007 Census of Agriculture. And what you find is not much change, at least in terms of farm numbers. 86-87% of farms and ranches in the U.S. are still owned by families or individuals. There is some family corporation that are often incorporated for estate planning or tax reasons. There are some partnerships, about 8%. Many of these are family partnerships. Some could be limited partnerships as well. Now, in terms of volume, I suppose other corporations would generally have larger operations than most of these families or individuals. But even if you do this on the basis of sales, the pie doesn't look much different. And another thing to think about is after all of this change and as we're going on, what do returns in these industries look like? I've taken the agribusiness sector here and broken it into production agriculture, food processing, wholesaling, and food retailing. And over the 10-11 year period that I'm showing here, the return on assets by industry is almost identical across these industries. Now, agriculture is right at the top there, or very close to the same as the others. In agriculture, of course, some of that return on assets includes inflationary aspects that are related to land, whereas with food processing, if I have a sugar refinery, it doesn't appreciate in value, it depreciates. So the source of those returns are slightly different. But nonetheless, economics would suggest that resources would move into areas that have high rates of return relative to those of low rates. And this is exactly the kind of thing that we would forecast if we're just starting from scratch. People will move those assets in and out, and there's been a fair bit of similarity among returns throughout these sectors on average. Now, let me talk real quickly then about agricultural productivity, because the productivity in agriculture over the last century has been almost four times that for the general economy itself. And the way to think about this is take a look at all the output that is produced by U.S. farms and ranches. I say farms a lot, I guess, as John mentioned. I'm from a farm, and I tend to use that vernacular more than ranches. But I'm meaning farm and ranches here. And what I've got is two lines on a chart here. This is just an index of the output of U.S. agriculture since 1948, the blue line, the top line. And if we just take because we have to add up bushels and pounds and all these sorts of things, you put it into an index and call 1948 our base, we can see that U.S. farm output and ranch output has increased by 2.5 times. Now, one way that we can increase output is by increasing the amount of inputs we use, land, labor, capital, all those sorts of things. Yet, when you look at the input usage over this time, it's the brownish line there, and it's almost dead flat. We use the same amount of total quantity of inputs today that we did in 1948, and we produce 2.5 times more output. Tremendous change in farm productivity. Again, one of those drivers that I mentioned a little bit earlier on. Now, while the amount of inputs have that are being used are very similar. The composition of those inputs are quite different. My slide 19 here shows, again, using an index approach, that the most striking thing here has been the increased use of chemicals, including fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides. This is the brownish line towards the top. That has increased very quickly through the Green Revolution in the 60s, sort of flattened out a little bit through the 80s, and has now seen an uptick throughout this decade, the end of the 90s and throughout this decade. Mechanical, really, we had this strong increase in the use of mechanization into about the early 1980s, and since that time, we've seen less. And again, that makes perfect sense. We have increased energy costs in general, and so people have substituted away from that. Plus, with the increases what we've had in labor costs, again, moving away from labor-intensive things to other means for producing things has been a major shift. If you look at the labor line, which is the most striking line here, the green line, we're using 20% of the labor today to produce all this output relative to the end of the 1940s. What has been the results of the productivity? What has caused the productivity change? The results of research and adoption of technologies has been tremendous changes in crop yields. Since 1950, soybean and wheat yields have now doubled since that time, and corn yields have gone up over four times. So when we think about productivity and where it's come from, it's reflected then in those crop yields. And the livestock sector has not been too far behind either. I calculate each year what I'll call the productivity of the U.S. beef cow breeding herd. And by taking how much carcass weight of pounds do we produce for every beef cow that's out there, we see that back in the 70s, this is almost a measure of weaning weights, almost, essentially. Back in the 70s, we were having a 500 pounds, 450 to 500 pounds of beef produced for every beef cow out there, and today that number's up near 700. So we're getting close to almost a twofold increase during that time as well. Why? Better genetics, better nutrition, animal health, all of those sorts of things, rebreeding rates, all those sorts of things have tremendous productivity changes built into them as well. Now, one of the things I do want to visit about, and again, it's pretty much the focus, I would think, of this seminar series, is on commodity price behavior. John Hewlett's going to be talking about Duane's work and his work and others on how you manage risk. And we can talk about production risk, which I know is a topic, Duane, as well, that's being – Duane and I are in the same office now, so I can look at him for some confirmation from time to time. But to be doing some production risk, but there's also the price risk element as well, which I know is a major topic of this seminar series. And of course, there is variability in prices. I just happen to have corn and wheat prices on slide 23. Back to 1909, I like to look at historical data, sort of fun. And you see wheat prices and corn prices, they bounce around a fair bit. And this is a part where I want to stop for or slow down just a minute and talk about why that happens. Because David Cole was visiting with you, and he has one perspective on why this happens. And I would say that I'm going to disagree with that, but that's okay, because I wouldn't be an academic if I didn't at some point disagree with somebody else. And so as an academic, I'm going to say that we see some variability in prices. And, of course, recently, very high prices, and I expect that we'll be back to a trend price in just a bit. Now, let me talk a little bit about the idea here of variability in these prices. David had mentioned that there were some mega cycles or trends or something like that occurred in World War I and then somewhere around World War II. And certainly World War I and World War II were responsible for some price increases at those times. There's no question about that. But then he'd mentioned that we had the Korean War and we had the Vietnam War and we had the Middle Eastern, Iraqi sort of war and Kuwait and all these sorts of things. And the reality of it is that these later green circles, these rise in prices, are not caused by political factors or anything like that. I mean, every time I've had a green circle up there, I'm sure the New York Yankees won an American League pennant sometime in there anyway. They had to have. They won so many of them. And we know that didn't cause those higher prices either. The reality of it is that economics can explain most of those price increases. I'm not saying that economists can predict them very well, but we can certainly explain them. David had mentioned an interesting, he uses this a lot in his talks. He argues that 80% of economics is actually psychology, that's what drives these markets. And I just beg to differ. I would agree. I would think that about 80% of psychology can be explained by economics, because incentives matter a lot. Even the insane respond to incentives. So I think a lot of psychology could be explained by economics. I don't think the converse is actually true. Let me talk a little bit then about why we see these price swings. We tend to think about these price increases that have occurred at various times, as noted by David. This, other than for World War I and World War II, economics provides the fundamental explanation for why we see these periods of above average or below average prices. And it's stuff that we teach and learn in our principles courses at the sophomore level in economics. We have relatively inelastic demands for food and agricultural commodities. If you're graphing this relatively steep supply demand curves. And when you have relatively small changes in world production, that can trigger large changes in price. That's where the variability comes from. When I said economists can't predict these swings, it's because we can't predict the weather. If I could, then I wouldn't tell you, by the way, any of you, because I can make a lot of money from this. But it's really a function of weather and, to some extent, some changes in demand, especially as we've seen corn demand increase because of ethanol production. But most of the time, demand for most of these commodities is relatively stable. Supply shocks cause most of these swings that we see in commodity prices. And of course, this is a good thing, right? We when we have high prices, it tells us we don't have enough stuff around, and it encourages people to produce more of it. And the converse is also true. Low prices are telling us there's too much stuff around, and the market doesn't want as much, and people will respond. Now, how does this help us then think about long run? I mean, this is, John, when you introduced me and I was thinking about long run price expectations, I expect to see short run high prices occasionally. I expect to see short run low prices. But over the long haul, commodity prices are going to gravitate towards the average cost of producing a product. We say, why would that be the case? Well, because when commodity prices are above the average cost of production, there's profits to be made. It invites entry. High prices, higher profits in any sector invites more people to join. My brother became a corn producer 3 years ago. Why? The price of corn was heading up. He wasn't a new producer he was not a new farmer, but he certainly jumped into the market when he had the appropriate signals. High prices invite entry, low prices encourage exit. And as a result of that, we will enter and exit an industry, and commodity markets in the long run, the best you can hope for on average, will be what economists call normal returns. Normal returns are those positive returns that are just high enough to keep you in the industry, to keep you from leaving the industry, and to not encourage more entry. That's the long-run equilibrium we're going to expect in commodity markets. So I think we can do a good job of forecasting what are long-run price expectations. Now, as we then think about the average cost of producing a bushel of wheat, we can also make the forecast that real or inflation-adjusted commodity prices are going to decline over time. Why? Well, commodity products, by definition, are undifferentiated. The only competitive strategy that a commodity producer is going to be able to use, because it is an undifferentiated product, is to be a low-cost producer. And to become a low-cost producer, one has to adopt those technologies that I talked about before. As everyone adopts better technologies, we lower unit costs of production and prices, because they're going to gravitate towards those unit costs and generate those average returns, is going to cause us to have declining inflation-adjusted commodity prices. This is certainly a good thing for consumers, okay? And for producers, it's a challenge. Let me give you a quick example here. I said I like data, especially historical data. Back, this is U.S. wheat prices, slide 27, starting in 1866. And for, I don't know, what is that, almost 80 years, we had a price that sort of jimmied around a dollar, got up in World War I up to $2, and then got back down. And since that time, nominal wheat prices have trended upward since about the 1940s. Now, what I want to show, and whenever I show this to producers, producers are quick to mention, and they're absolutely right, yeah, Gary, the prices have gone up, but so have my input prices, fertilizer, fuel, seed, labor. And I said, absolutely right. So let me take that same series and deflate it. Let me take inflation out of this picture, and those producers are absolutely correct. Inflation-adjusted commodity prices have declined. By the way, that's true for computers. That's true for calculators. That's true for airline transportation. And over the long haul, it's also true for oil. Because of definition of commodity prices, technological change will cause this to happen. Now, what the flip side of this story then is wheat yields since 1866. And those wheat yields were kind of around 15 bushels an acre until after World War II. And I showed some yield data earlier. This is just putting this into a longer time series. Certainly yields since the Depression have been going upward on wheat and even more so on corn. Now, here's what I want to do. I want to take the inflation-adjusted price for wheat and multiply it by the yields that we get for wheat. So I'm going to take out inflation and add in, which puts a downward pressure on inflation-adjusted prices, and then we have the wheat yields, which is the production that's coming off of an acre of wheat. And when you do that, you get, again, some variability, which what this conference is all about, in inflation-adjusted revenue per acre. Inflation-adjusted price times yield. And, of course, it jumps up and down because of weather and price changes and all those kinds of things. But here's one of the most remarkable pieces of data that I've uncovered as I've worked on this problem. And that is, what is the trend in revenue per acre in wheat? So I took a linear trend line and just ran a regression and fit it to this data. Take a look at the data. Can you see what's going to happen? Maybe not, but my question is the trend up or down on revenue, inflation-adjusted revenue per acre? And we're looking at 142 years of data here, okay? The pink line, slide 31, shows the trend, and there is no significant slope coefficient on that trend line. Folks, the trend is dead flat. 142 years, and revenue per acre adjusted for inflation is still the same as what it was in 1866. If I had to forecast the future, I'd say the next 50 years, the pink line will prevail. Why? For the discussion I've just completed regarding commodity production. If we're way above that trend line, more people will get into the industry, will drive the price of wheat down. If we're below it for too long of a time, people will move out. And even if demand goes up, if that increases the profitability in that industry, we will have entry. I think it's one of the most remarkable things. By the way, we could do this for corn. Cattle's a little harder because the product has changed. But if you take any commodity that you can adjust for quality, you're going to see exactly the same behavior in the data. What do we learn from that? What are the management implications then? Well, agricultural producers operate in one of the most competitive sectors. In fact, that's what we use in our classrooms. We talk about agriculture as one of the closest form we have to perfectly competitive markets. Now, agricultural producers often don't perceive themselves in competition with their neighbor, unlike the beef packing companies who consider themselves in competition with their people, or Cargill versus Bungie or any of the other grain companies. They don't perceive themselves in competition, but they certainly are. This is why agribusinesses in general, the Cargills of the world, are not really interested in being agricultural commodity producers. The best they can hope for is a normal rate of return. They can't keep entry from occurring. And so that's not a very attractive, strategically, a very attractive business to be in. For any producer, then, to earn above average returns, they've got to be one of the low-cost operators in that particular line of work. And this provides a huge role for price risk management. John will be visiting about this, John Hewlett, in a little while. But my story to producers out there in the in Montana and in the rest of the country is, you know, when we see a record price, you really ought to take it. It's not going to last forever for all of the reasons that I've talked. It's not about psychology. It's about supply and demand. And wheat prices have been very high for 2 years because we had 2 years of pretty poor world production. We've had 2 years of good production, and now they're low. I'm reminded of a very successful wheat farmer that I saw at a restaurant one day, and I walked by him and I said, how are things going? And this was about a year ago, and he goes, just my luck. He says, price of wheat's $14 a bushel and I don't have any to sell. And I looked at him and I said, that's because you sold it all at 12, and that's a heck of a price. And he laughed and smiled and said, you're right, it's buying dinner tonight at least. So when we see record prices, folks, we want to take advantage of those. I very often, John Hewlett, I know Dwayne gets the same sort of thing, and all you extension educators out there, whenever prices are low, we usually get people to call us and say, will you come out and tell us how to use the futures market to get a better price? Well, that's a nice thought, but it doesn't work that way. That's not what the futures market is for. It's to manage risk. And if you've already got a low price, you don't have to worry about it going much lower. So we don't have much help in those times. Let me sum up this particular section, and then that this provides some context for our current situation. Commodity market prices are certainly below recent record levels, but they remain above the long-run average, and they will always be trying to get towards that long-run average. The question becomes, will they be below a long-run average price for a long period of time, or will they be above? And it all comes down to, have we had anything that has permanently influenced demand? And I think we have for corn. I think we will now see $3.50 corn more than $2 corn because of increased demand. But on the cost side, have we really seen any fundamental shift in what the long-run costs are for producing a commodity? If we have, then I would predict that our long-run prices will rise over time, but not to a great extent. The best you can hope for is to run the race and end up in a tie. David Cole did a nice job of explaining some of the use of trends for evaluating land purchases, and he very carefully cautioned everyone that whenever we start thinking we're going to see a $5 corn price forever and we start buying land based upon a record price, we are setting in motion all sorts of huge problems. That is, if you're going to borrow money to purchase that land based upon those trends. So we certainly want to use trends. And as David was mentioning, it's the repayment capacity that's based upon these unrealistically high prices that cause the problem. So we need to be thinking about the trends that I've laid out here. Where do we really think prices are going to be over the time it's going to take to repay the debt on that particular land? So Dave did a nice job of laying that out. Let me work through in just the next, I got a little bit of a late start here. We're still okay, Dwayne. The last couple things, the role of strategic business management. And I've talked very much about a lot of this already. In these competitive markets, entry and exit of firms will cause these industry to earn normal returns. Yet within every industry, some firms will earn below average returns and some above. The industry is going to do average. Why do some firms do better than others? This was a huge undertaking by Michael Porter at the Harvard Business School about 20 years ago, who pioneered the concept of strategic business management. And he said, what determines that difference? Why are some above average and some are below? And there's all sorts of things. Luck's a good thing. I've noticed that good managers tend to have better luck. But I think whenever you can use, you know, have good luck, that's a great thing. Along with luck, one might add, it's always good to pick your parents well. I tell my students this all the time. If you want to be successful, just be a Rockefeller. You have a good chance of having some success then. I always consider marrying well to be a really good thing to do, too, for a number of reasons. But that's another way to help out on the success. But beyond those two, what about other things? Well, you know, innovation and capitalization, taking care of debt structures, your management expertise and your attitudes and ability to manage risk becomes important, along with our selected management strategies. So let's think about the management strategies. Successful firms pick one of three strategies that leads to a competitive advantage. Either they're going to be a low-cost producer in order to outcompete their neighbors, they're going to be producing a differentiated product or a focused strategy. Again, all of this from Michael Porter's work. A low-cost producer is just got to be that firm that's going to be a low enough cost producer that they can survive those times of low prices. Maybe a producer of commodity beef, for example, would be an example of someone who tries to be a low-cost producer through the adoption of technology, increasing productivity, managing both costs and risk as well. Typical strategy employed by commodity producers in agriculture. Second strategy is a differentiation strategy. That is producing some product that's truly different. Perhaps an example in the beef industry would be either a certified Angus beef product or something that's widely distributed and accessible. Maybe it's a differentiated strategy based upon convenience or consistency, service, those kinds of things. Not typically used by ag producers because differentiation is both costly and it's risky. A focus strategy is the third identified by Michael Porter, and this means just concentrating on a specific or a niche market. Maybe as an example of beef industry, a Laura's lean beef or any of the narrow branded products that exist out there. Again, increased dependence though on either single source suppliers of inputs or single source providers of your output are another source of risk that I know John Hewlett and Dwayne are visiting with people about throughout this program. Bottom line, what's the best strategy, Gary, if you know so much? Well, the answer is I don't know. It depends upon the industry in, your ability to handle risk, your skill set. I do, however, know the worst strategy. The worst strategy is not having one. Michael Porter called it being stuck in the middle. I can't outcompete anybody in any area. I don't produce a different product. I don't have a skill that I can use to help market that product. And I'm not a low-cost producer. Those folks end up with below-average profits. Final section here, Dwayne and John Newkirk, just a couple more quick things. I'm going to be speaking later today on this topic. Is there a future for agriculture? Well, there's a future. I think the question is there a dim or a bright future for U.S. agriculture? And quite frankly, folks, I say grab your shades. I mean, we have so many advantages and so many opportunities that I think the future is quite bright. In what way or why do I think bright, or in what way do I mean bright? I mean, we're going to continue to have the opportunities to receive normal profits on average over the long run in all of these industries. But in addition to that, we have private and public research efforts that have tremendous improvements in productivity and efficiencies. We have tremendous institutional strength in the U.S. Strong property rights are essential for a productive economy, a stable political environment. I know we think that we don't have a stable environment, but we've only had one civil war in the last 300 years, and that's one too many. We have an economy that allows us at least to function, and that's something that many, many countries don't have. U.S. has fantastic infrastructure, as do many other countries, by the way. But we have the really strength in the financial institutions that we have. Yeah, we've had some problems. We didn't have enough regulation in some of these. I don't think there's any question about that. But overall, credit can be obtained. Risk management opportunities exist for both production and price risk. We have tremendous research and education that all of you folks are involved in one form or another. None of this is by accident. This is a function of market-oriented systems properly regulated with strong property rights. I think one of the things that we can't lose sight of is that firms have to be able to keep some of those profits to compensate for risk-taking. If we tax all of those profits away through a variety of things, we lose incentives, and I think that has very strong implications for productivity. Who has that bright future? Those that have a strategic advantage, those that produce commodities and are able to generate low-cost advantages through size or technological change or some sort of efficiency. In the case of my dad, he obtained this by getting rid of me and making a capital for labor substitution. There's another source of efficiency. Or we're going to see differentiated or focused producers who need to be excellent entrepreneurs. Dwayne and I know of Wheat Montana, the Dean Folkford's operation out here, where he's raising his own high-protein wheat. He's baking it. He's making bagels. He's selling bread all over the state and into the region. Wonderful situation, something I could never have done. I went to school with Dean. He's tremendous entrepreneur, works tremendously hard. There are going to be opportunities for folks like that. It takes a special set of skills. So with that, Dwayne, I hope I haven't gone too long. And John Newkirk, but I'm at the end of my set of slides, and I hope this provided you with something that you can think about. And we're going to ask questions now, Dwayne? Or?
Okay. We'll take some of them as similar. And one of the first ones is, You identified what you thought are advantages here, and the question was, how can domestic producers remain competitive with imports, mm-hmm. given the regulatory environment that they face?
Yep. An excellent question. We will have a disadvantage when it comes to regulations, but I'm convinced we offset that to a certain extent because of food safety and quality control and how we produce things. I mean, ultimately, consumers do care about that, especially in developed countries. For those countries that don't care about those things, I think we will continue to struggle in those markets, and they're just not going to be the markets that we're going to want. So I argue that, there are some advantages in these other countries, but most of these countries that don't have the same regulatory environment as the U.S. also don't have the infrastructure technologies as well. Remember, wheat can be produced in a lot of places, and so if it's a lot cheaper and a lot easier and a lot less expensive to do it elsewhere, we would do a lot more of it elsewhere. Again, these resources do move around. I think we have enough evidence, John, that we can compete. It's always harder, though, don't get me wrong, but in some sense, those regulations can be helpful in terms of consumer confidence. Can we overregulate? Absolutely.
You mentioned kind of three aspects: commodity, low cost. You mentioned focus, which mm-hmm. I interpret as value added. So is mm-hmm. there a future yep. in value added market approach to commodities?
Well, absolutely. But I think we have to be careful in terms of value added. What we're meaning here is there, can I do something better by creating more value in a product than somebody else? And let me explain that. We have a processing system in the beef sector that is able to do that much more efficiently than individual farmers can do it and small local processing plants. So on the one hand, you have to ask yourself the question, what aspect of value added, what is going to be the competitive advantage that I'm going to create? I'll go back to Dean Folkford and Wheat Montana. Again, I did a quick overview of that, but it's pretty easy to find on the web. We have tremendous examples of people that have taken a lot of risk, but they've been excellent entrepreneurs who have gone all the way to the consumer in terms of taking wheat and making bread, or taking beef and making a steak. There's lots of examples of that. The point I want to make is that there are niche markets or focused or differentiated markets for all of those kinds of things, but they're often not very large, and not everybody's very good at it. Let me give you an example. My brother raises a variety of irrigated crops. The last thing that he wants to do is be closer to the consumer. Because he's a bad guy? No, it's not his skill set. He has no interest in that. He's really good at producing the commodities that he produces, and he knows that. He's been, in a sense, forced into being closer to the consumer through a cooperative effort because he raises sugar beets, and he's a member of a sugar beet co-op that owns the factories. One of the greatest sense of risk that has been heightened has been that he's had to put investment into something that he no longer controls, that he has to depend upon other managers and things, and he's very close to the consumer, and he's the kind of guy that doesn't like it very much. So I think we have to be careful when we say value added. It always sounds like that's got to be a good thing. But when we say value added, and John, I appreciate the question, and you certainly, and most of us do, think about this. We not only mean increasing the total revenue from an operation, but we have to also recognize that that also is going to have an increase in total costs. As economists, we certainly understand that if the revenue isn't going to go up more than the costs are going to go up, the value-added component is not sustainable. So there are opportunities. There always will be. There always has been. But it's not for everybody, and we can't have a wheat Montana operation and bakery in every county in this state, nor in any of the others.
And we've got one last question, Gary, and then we're going to move on to John Hewlett. And it's how do you think that the ethnic composition of the U.S. population and the shifts and change that are going on will impact ag and markets?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, one of the major ethnic shifts, of course, has been Hispanics. Hispanics are traditional high protein consumers, and I think it does change the type of beef products that are going to be demanded. So I think in particular, the beef industry and the pork industry have to be thinking about how do they position their products to meet some of those tastes and preferences that we're talking about in terms of the changing ethnicity composition. And we're primarily talking about a bigger proportion of the population being Hispanic. And I think we have to think a little bit more about what does that general group want in terms of convenience? Or is it different? I don't know, John, but those are the kinds of things I think the beef, pork, and poultry industry have to be thinking about. Is there a significant change? There may be no difference at all, but it's something they need to investigate.
Well, Gary, thank you very much. I don't know about the rest of the audience, but I really enjoyed your presentation and the information you provided. And drive careful as you head on out further into western Montana. I guess my image is Bozeman's western Montana, but there is quite a bit left to the west of that. So
there is, John. Thank you so much for your comments and for inviting me here. And I just want John Hewlett to know that I'll be listening to his presentation later on when I get back. So I want you to hold his feet to the fire a little bit.
We will do that.
Okay.
Thank you very much. And I'm really pleased to be able to introduce John Hewlett now. And John's been a member of our Ag and Uncertain Times team that has thought and put this together and reached out. And when we were discussing kind of this whole idea of how you handle managing risk and in a way that is meaningful in a webinar context, because you know, we could consume all of the time with just one or two tools. We came right back around that probably there was no one better to talk about this than John himself. And John is a farm and rich management specialist at the University of Wyoming, and a member of the regional right risk and risk navigator teams. And he also coordinated past efforts of the regional WIRE program. He has a farm background in Washington State. He had worked 8 years as a foreman Four is a foreman on a large stock or cattle crop operation, and he holds degrees from Montana State and Oregon State University. And my own experience with John, it's hard for me to think of a better, more grounded, practical ag economist than John. And he and his family operate a small farm and ranch 20 miles outside of Laramie, and it's where they have several commercial and small animal enterprises. So, John, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, John, for those kind words of introduction, and thank you all to the team for the opportunity for the to make this presentation this morning. I think we have some things to offer, and certainly understand that we are facing uncertain times in the current outlook. Certainly following Dr. Brester this morning points up just one example of uncertainty that we face. But I did appreciate Gary's comments. I've worked with him in the past to make presentations around in the region, and I always enjoy his insights and perspectives. And thank you for your introduction, Gary, by that means. Well, I'd like to start this morning with a question. What does this graph represent? I do this with live audiences around, and it's interesting to hear people's perspectives. Some people will guess that it's prices, input costs, maybe competition, risk. In the end, I think the answer is it could be just about anything. We're facing change in all kinds of dimensions of our agricultural enterprises. Changes Gary has touched on a number of this morning in his presentation, information, technology, opportunities even. So the point that I would make about this change and what we see happening around us is that to continue doing the same thing and expecting a different kind of a result in the changed world is probably not very realistic, particularly into the future as we look at what strategies should we be following and using. And what we points up is that we really need a different approach, a different way of thinking about those opportunities and a process or a way to recognize what opportunities are good for us and our situation and which ones we should not pursue because things they would not fit our situation. And so a process is kind of what is needed. Gary already touched on this a little bit. I've done a number of programs in my career in talking about strategic planning for agriculture. But strategic thinking is really the approach that I think represents the best method for us to start looking at these changes. It would allow us in a holistic way or a way that considers all the aspects of a particular farm or ranch to understand what threats or opportunities might be presented in certain things that come down the road and that we need to choose between choices or chances to actually invest or to get involved in a new commodity, as Gary talked about, for example, with corn in his family farm, perhaps even using a new approach or a new variety. But we also need to recognize the resource limitations that we face in our own situation and that what we really need to do is find solutions that will work for that set of resources that we have available to us. I love this quote from Peter Drucker. It says, the best way to predict the future is to actually create it. The implication, though, is that it puts the responsibility for action and for decision-making squarely in our court, and that effort is required on our part to help make that change happen for the better. I'm going to talk a little bit this morning about a process that we've put together for strategically managing risk. And I'm speaking for a team of Western ag economists who actually have put this together. Dwayne Griffith, who's been helping and has made a presentation in these webinars already, is one of those members. Dr. Dana Hoag at Colorado State University was the lead on this, and a number of other players, which I'll mention later, but have been involved in developing this process. And while strategic planning has been often used for general business and business management, it's not been often applied to agriculture, as pointed out by Gary, but But certainly, we've not seen it applied to risk and risk management in agricultural enterprises. And so my challenge this morning is to try to step through these 10 steps in a brief way to introduce you to some of this material that we've put together. And just by way of reminder, it might be important for us to think just a minute about what risk is that we're talking about. In the context that we're discussing this morning, risk, and when we think about it, is really the probability of an event occurring that could impact profit, we usually think of, or second, most frequently, we might think of changing our equity position or our ability to stay in business in the long term. But finally, we might also think about our satisfaction and well-being, and risks certainly can impact that and make us question perhaps why we're even involved in some of the things that we're facing, particularly when prices are not moving in our favor or the challenges of the current day really seem to be greater than they used to be. Well, what are the sources of risk? I mean, Gary talked quite a little bit about risk in some of his comments, but in general, it's been defined that there are five sources of risk, and he talked about the first two more than the last three, but production and marketing risk are the things we think of most often in agriculture as being sources of risk and variability in our returns over time. Certainly financial risks are more prevalent today, as we've seen in this webinar series and heard from various lenders about the risk, and we're hearing more in the media about bank failures. Our ability to repay our debts and to stay in business in the long haul really hinges on our financial health and ability to stand that risk and manage it well. In agriculture, we also face increasing legal risks, whether they be contracts or other kinds of binding arrangements that are much more formalized today than they used to be. And the last category we don't often think about in ag, but is very important, is the human resource risk. Not only the employees and folks that help get the work done, but also the managers and perhaps family members that are involved in helping to make the big decisions on whatever farm and ranch we might be looking at managing. So today I want to touch on some of the material that's actually just been compiled and is available in this textbook called Applied Risk Management in Agriculture. This is just newly off the press. In fact, I just received my copy of this text last week in the mail. So it's just newly released, but we also have a website that accompanies this book and provides some additional information to support the chapters in it. I will talk a little more about that at the end of this presentation, but I just wanted to let you know there's a lot greater depth to this material than what I'm going to present and have time for this morning. The first step of this process is the strategic step. It's basically the first third of the steps that we've outlined, and it really is about setting the direction for the operation. It also establishes, through kind of an inventorying process, what it is we've got to work with to help accomplish the goals and objectives that we set out for ourselves. So the first step in the strategic section of this process is to determine the health of the financial resources that we have at our disposal or under our control. We're trying to determine here what the extent and adequacy is of those resources to actually service all of the enterprise activities for our current operations. And how do we do that exactly? Not everybody's familiar with this, but the first cut of an answer would be that we usually calculate various measures of financial performance. It's liquidity, solvency, profitability, financial efficiency, and repayment capacity, all different kinds of measures of the same set of performance for a particular operation. And we can do that by calculating a number of different financial ratios and measures. The Sweet 16 that's listed there is a set that were developed to kind of get a quick snapshot of where things stand. But how do we, you might be wondering, how we actually calculate those things and where does that information come from? Well, it comes from the financial statements that folks, a lot of people know they should be keeping them, but maybe not everybody keeps them up to date like they should. But the typical balance sheet that we need to keep track of, where what our assets and our liabilities, what's owed, what's owned, our statement of cash flows, where is our cash coming in, when's it going out, So it's the timing, but also the magnitude of the flow of that cash. The income statement, and here we're talking about an accrual-based income statement, which is a measure of profitability, the only accurate measure of profitability that we can assess for an operation, and is extremely critical to complete. And that also would then include a statement of owner equity, actually showing how owner equity is changing over time and what is causing that change to actually occur. It might also be important for us to think about and perhaps take a look at other resources that we have at our disposal. Things like the status of our crops and how we're doing in performance there, improvements perhaps that we've made recently, where we stand in terms of human potential, in terms of our own improvement perhaps, or training, or others that are involved in the operation, and what kinds of things that that they may need assistance in or need to be brought up to speed on in changes that in areas that they may be responsible for. This next step then of the process is to actually take a look at what is our risk preference. That is, what is our tolerance for risk? it's important to note that can actually change, somewhat like personalities change from one person to another. It may also change because of our own experiences. My experiences may be different than, say, my spouse's in an operation. And then furthermore, they change and adjust over time as we move through by stage of life and our various responsibilities and things that come along with various stages of life as we move along. And so our attitude toward risk is important, and it's somewhat personal, but it also may change between individuals based upon the type of risk, because not everybody perceives, for example, market risks as being equally threatening, or perhaps production risk, depending on, again, their background and so on. So within this step of the process, we're taking a look at what is the risk preference, and it can be measured, and we have some tools to help people do that, but it's also dynamic and changes over time. So just because we measure it today doesn't mean that that's always going to be your perspective on it into the future, and certainly is influenced by a number of different factors, as I've just mentioned. So when we measure it, it's actually measuring your current risk preference, which may or may not be appropriate into the future. There are certainly a number of different kinds of trade-offs with risk, and Gary mentioned a number of those in his presentation, but it's important to remember that how you view risk is likely different than others that are involved in the operation. So that means that given a certain situation, not everybody sees the same set of alternatives, nor will everyone have the same comfort level when evaluating those choices and the strategies or actions that those choices might imply for the operation into the future. In general, though, there are three different types of risk preference that ag economists like to use, being risk-averse, risk-neutral, and risk-loving. So the risk-averse person actually would prefer an investment with a lower return but a more certain payoff, as compared to an investment with a higher return but a more uncertain payoff. So that's a person that, again, is sort of averse to risk and would try to avoid it where possible. A risk-neutral person, on the other hand, actually doesn't really care about the risk that's in the situation, but rather focuses on the payoff and really doesn't take risk into account when comparing alternatives. An example of a person like this might actually self-insure against loss as opposed to purchasing insurance. And then there's the risk-loving person, is someone who actually engages in risky investments. We may not see that so much in agriculture, but if you go to a casino in Las Vegas, you see a lot of those folks there at the slot machine. So in general, with this area of risk tolerance, we're really looking at not only your preference for managing and carrying risk, but also the trade-off that the risk and returns offer in a various decisions that a person or a ranch farm may be facing and needing to choose between. And it's important, again, to recognize that not everybody sees those risks and returns in the same light. And that may actually help explain, especially when times are uncertain and things are somewhat unsettled, how people see things differently and how they may make different choices or get upset when other people are making a certain set of choices that they don't quite understand why they're doing. The third step then in the strategic process is to try to determine where you're headed with your risk management strategy. So actually setting goals in terms of risk for the operation. That not only needs to be done by source of risk, but it should also describe the specifics of how you're planning to get there. So this long-term goals as well as intermediate tactical objectives, etc., but also considering the resource constraints of the operation. So here's a diagram that kind of explains how we present this in the text. Is you would start off with a mission statement that kind of forms a foundation or the roots in this case of a tree diagram of for the entire operation, that you would set the goals, objectives, and plans that would lead you to accomplishing that over the long run. And these goals actually ought to be written down. And if you do so, they should be SMART, as it says, which means they should be specific, measurable, attainable, related, and tractable over time. Furthermore, I think it helps a lot to calculate the cost of these long-term or strategic goals for the operation, not only because it's helpful to figuring out what it will take to actually accomplish those goals, but also because it is a good way of measuring how quickly or how close to achieving those goals we are moving over time. So it serves as a benchmark and a way of tracking our progress over time. So in general, this strategic management section is really looking at the big picture. It's describing for us where we're heading and actually what it might look like once we've arrived. It helps to keep the operation focused, especially if the goals are written out. And as such, it allows for proactive management in the face of opportunities or perhaps in the face of uncertainty as we are facing in a number of markets today. This kind of describes what I'm trying to outline here in terms of how strategic goals form the ultimate destination, but tactical objectives actually show waypoints along the way that we need to achieve and move through as we head towards those strategic goals, while the operational plans are really more about the day-to-day and on-the-ground management of that process of moving forward as we go. All right, let's move to the tactical section then. In this section, we're really talking about how we're going to achieve those strategic goals over the long term. So it's really looking at doing the right things, actually making choices about what things to be involved in doing and making sure that they're done in the right way. So the first step of that is to actually look at the specific sources of risk that we're facing, to evaluate those sources of risk in terms of their consequences and implications for our management, but also to prioritize our responses to those sources of risk. So to start that off, we would actually look at these sources of risk. I mentioned the five sources, because not all of them will impact us in the same way, let alone would have the same consequence or even the same timing for the operation. And so that set of factors, as well as the change in our perspective on those risks, actually will determine maybe what our response ought to be or alternatives that we would consider or not consider as a result. So as we look at those sources of risk, we need to think about the magnitude of those sources, the timing, and then again the impact or consequence that they represent for the operation, and that they change over time. They're not the same during the same point perhaps in any one year, but also within a year they may actually fluctuate around and represent greater or lesser threats depending on the situation. And the challenge here, of course, is to think about what the implications are for our management decision making. The next step, the fifth step, is actually then looking at what management alternatives are available to us. And we'll need to consider alternatives as we move closer toward our goals and will these different choices available to us to manage risk move us closer or further away from where we really want to end up in the long run? We also need to think about the cost of those alternatives. And furthermore, as we choose or look at what choices are available to us, how will that change our risk profile? We choose one strategy, may increase our risk in certain areas or may diminish the risks in others, and what are the trade-offs between those? And so at this stage of the game, we're trying to look at the trade-offs between those various dimensions of the decision. In general, there are four different responses to risk that people talk about, and those are listed here on the screen, the first being assuming the risk, actually taking it on, avoiding it, so trying to move away from it or make decisions that would take us away from that situation that where the risk is present, reducing the risk, so taking steps to make sure that that risk is not such a great threat or diminish its threat to the operation as a whole, or potentially transferring those risks to another entity. So the challenge is to see how do those fit given the risks that we face and the dynamics in terms of our own personal perspective on those risks. The sixth step then moves into estimating the likelihood of the outcomes from the various choices that might be available to us. So this is another way of actually evaluating the extent of the risk and its threat by source of risk to the operation. We do that by actually looking at making a statistical estimation. And statistics, I know, is not for everybody, but through the text and some of the tools that we've outlined with this material, we have put together some things that would help people who are not statisticians actually make estimates of some of the likelihoods of the things and decisions that they're considering, some of the consequences, and then can then estimate the extent of the consequence to their decision and weigh those against various other alternatives. It can be very helpful in developing a risk management strategy, we found in working with producers in using this process. Final step then of the tactical stage of the process is ranking those risk return trade-offs and then making a decision. So here we're trying to identify the best management alternative that would fit our current situation. And then suggesting that we need to make a choice. If we're going to adjust our management moving forward, we probably need to make some changes. So as part of that, we look at comparing these various alternatives, whether it be assuming, avoiding, reducing, or transferring the risk, and how would that leave us given the various choices that we're facing. And then finally, like I say, making the choice, actually considering those alternatives side by side, looking at the pros and cons of each, and then making a choice. A lot of folks actually go about the process of collecting a lot of information, get it together in the right place, but fail to make the choice. But instead, let nature take its course and just don't make a choice. And as a result, choices are made or consequences are absorbed as the markets evolve and as the scene unfolds moving forward. That is not, by the way, the type of management that we're advocating with this process. The last section of the process that we've put together is the operational management, focused on doing the doing on a day-to-day basis, describing the steps that need to be accomplished to achieve the strategic goals that we've set out. So it's about doing things right, or correctly, you might say, as we move forward as managers. The first step in that section, then, it would be implementing the plan, describing what activities need to occur on a week-to-week basis, day-to-day basis, to implement the plans and the strategy that we've laid out in the previous sections. It also would describe who is going to be responsible and when those activities ought to take place. So it's about putting things and the strategy into action, following the tactics that we've outlined to achieve those strategic goals, but also considering the constraints of the financial health and risk preferences that we outlined in the strategic section of the process in general. Not only do we need to implement the plans, but we also need to monitor and adjust as we go along, making sure that resources are used in the pattern that we proposed and that the risks are being managed in the way that we outlined in our risk management plan. The reason being, of course, is that the best laid plans rarely go exactly as they were drawn up. And so we absolutely must monitor and adjust to keep our business on course as we move forward. So at this stage of the game, we're worried about managing and being sure that we're doing the right things, that day-to-day, month-to-month, we're continuing to do the right things as outlined in the plan, but also that those things are being done correctly and that, again, resource use and so on is as we described and as we had planned for. Obviously, along the way, and maybe goes without saying, but communication is absolutely essential, not only among the players in the farm and ranch, but also among family members, and that often sometimes does not happen, and that causes some consternation. But I might also point out that it is important, especially in uncertain times, that that communication happens with those other folks, other supporting entities that help us as a farm and ranch manager accomplish our business. And those might include bankers or creditors, accountants, other folks that need to be apprised of what our plans are and how we are planning to move forward into the coming year. The last step of the entire process, step 10, is that we need to replan or reevaluate our progress at least on an annual basis. It's important to check and see how things are actually going and to make sure the plans that we laid out earlier are still appropriate. We need to make sure that we are even on the same map. Sometimes major shifts will occur in personal life or in the business, which could cause us to reconsider everything in light of those changes. And so where we're headed and where we want to end up can change in a major way over time, and so the map itself may actually need to be adjusted. So in summary, our hope with this is that the process that we've outlined will allow users of it to consider risk and risk management with a strategic perspective. So in that way, what we're saying is it describes for us where we want to go with our strategic goals, considering where we are now in terms of our financial health and risk preference, as well as the sources of risk that we're facing, and then the plans that we've laid out in terms of tactical and operational planning of how we're going to get there, the specifics. And if this process is followed, our hope is that it better positions farms and ranch families for the future as they face uncertainty. So I mentioned earlier that there's a lot greater depth in the text that's just been released. There's basically a chapter dedicated to each of these 10 steps I've just glossed over this morning. And in addition, there are chapters on each of the 5 sources of risk, and various alternatives are mentioned throughout as to how to manage those 5 sources of risk in those chapters. So a lot more material and a lot greater depth. In addition, there is this website that provides information on the book if you're interested in ordering it, but it also provides information on the case farm that is used throughout this text as a basis for walking folks through the concepts we're talking about in terms of the strategic risk management, but also in the application of the tools, because there are also tools, over 40 tools that we've designed to accompany this 10-step process. And so next week we have scheduled a webinar where we will be presenting some of those tools and highlighting how they might work to address uncertain times into the future. So with that, John, I want to thank you again for the opportunity to present this information about the strategic risk management process and to mention the Risk Navigator tools. And at this point, I would welcome any questions that folks who've been listening in might have.
Yeah, John, thanks. A lot of information here, really nicely laid out, and thank you. And I do have some questions. If those of you in the audience have some additionally, please type them into the chat pod over here on the left. And Shammy would like you to repeat again and go through what was that acronym and what does it stand for?
Okay. SMART is an acronym that's often used particularly in strategic goal setting that stands for specific, that is the goals that you write out and the statements that you describe for your goals should be specific. That is, they should contain detailed information. They should be measurable, so they should contain some dimension of measurability, whether it be cost or timing, et cetera, the extent of resources that might need to be used. The goals need and the statements need to be attainable. They shouldn't be just pie in the sky, but they should actually consider what resources you've got to draw from and be attainable, or are, in this case, is realistic. They need to be realistic and or related to one another, so that you can't have goal, or you shouldn't at least have goals that pull you in opposite directions, because obviously you can only accomplish so many things. So if they're related to one another, hopefully they're helping to drive you in a kind of a common direction. And then T, finally, is tractable over time, that they are actually something that you can track and keep, have a time dimension to the goal statement itself. So again, specific, measurable, attainable, related, or realistic, and tractable over time.
Thank you. And another question is, and it's come up around other issues as we've worked through this webinar series. From your experience, what are the biggest impediments that prevent producers from starting and using a strategic risk management process?
It's been my experience in working with farms and ranch families is that in general, it's probably an intimidation, a factor of intimidation. Folks are not generally comfortable doing this type of planning. And so they're not only not comfortable in terms of the communication aspect of working with other family members and so on in making these decisions, but they may also be not so comfortable in terms of the information they've got to draw from and see that is a lot of work to have to pull together all of that, and perhaps don't see all the benefits that would come from having that information together. My argument and how I try to present this is in a proactive way, is that having these kind of strategic goals and knowing where you're headed allows you to look at, you know, present time opportunities, things or decisions that you need to make today, and seeing how perhaps some opportunities don't fit because they would take you in a different direction as opposed to, you know, other kinds of decisions that you might make that actually may move you toward your goals in the long run. But with that said, I think it's really an important, or it can be an important strategy for facilitating that communication within families. I find that that's often the greatest hurdle, is that not everybody is on the same page. Nobody knows, for example, what dad's really thinking and where he thinks the operation ought to go, let alone where Junior and his wife, who, you know, theoretically would be moving into management down the road, what they're thinking, if they've had college training and so on, what skills they've got, what they see as some of the opportunities. So that communication and this whole strategic process, I think, is critical to follow in some way, shape, or form. It may not have to follow exactly these same steps, but to start that communication and to get people talking so that they can get on the same page and they'll all be working toward the same end over time.
And given Gary's presentation about long-term outlook, his optimism, what do you see as any particular strategies that producers should follow, or do they need to try to figure out how to cover all the bases?
Well, not surprisingly, I'm going to respond from the perspective I've just presented, and that is that I really think that folks need to get involved, especially if they're facing uncertainty, if they're not certain about their credit situation, if they've been asked to provide additional documentation to the bank this winter, if they're uncertain about the markets that they're facing going forward, if they're uncertain about the input costs and how they're going to manage given the margins that they've seen this past production season, if they're uncertain about a lot of those things, they, one, need to be on the same page themselves. And so I'm a strong advocate of trying to get folks to communicate and at least be on the same page within their family or the operation in general. Whether they follow, again, a 10-step process in terms of doing that, I guess that depends on the family and their situation. Some families best benefit from using an outside person to facilitate a family meeting. And we've done some programs, and I've got other materials that we've organized to help farm families actually accomplish that. other people can do it themselves and can rotate a chairmanship between each other to facilitate that communication within the family unit. But I think it's absolutely critical that folks who are, again, are facing uncertainty be on the same page, not only within their family, but also, as I mentioned earlier, with their banker, with their accountant, maybe with the Forest Service if they're using public lands. Other aspects of the operation need to be considered, and the other people and their needs for information are critical to being successful, especially when times are unsettled. So I think the strategy is to think about some of the things I've touched on today in terms of what is the direction we're headed, what kind of a strategy do we all think we ought to follow, and then what is the best way that we think we can, as a group, implement that strategy going forward. And again, if you're not on the same page facing these challenges, I think that's where a lot of times we push comes to shove, and families get in trouble and are unable to perhaps live up to or withstand the challenges from the outside that the uncertainty actually presents. So again, I don't know whether, you know, this 10-step process is the magic one, but I really think folks need to think about some of these dimensions and how they plan to address them into the future for their own success.
One of our audience members wonders, are there some software tools that can be used to guide the risk evaluation, setting goals and objectives process?
Excellent question. I would invite you to tune in next week on November 11th at the same time and place. We will be covering some of the 40-plus tools that we've developed, all of which are electronic and are available free to the public as part of the website that I mentioned earlier. But yes, we have the tools to help evaluate risks, to evaluate your own risk tolerance, to look at setting goals and objectives, number of worksheets, and electronic tools to help folks actually do that. So that's part of this Risk Navigator tool set that I mentioned in the presentation, but we will be covering in a 90-minute presentation next Wednesday.
I think you've already probably answered this, John, but maybe I'll ask it again. It's another one of the questions that we have. It says, the producers you know that have started this process, where do they get hung up? Where do they most often get hung up?
Well, I think my experience with farm and ranch families is that it can vary depending on who the family is and kind of their history and where they want to go. You know, some folks get hung up on the first part of the process in terms of pulling the information together. Other folks get hung up because they're not comfortable communicating with other family members, and they're not comfortable with being open and perhaps addressing problems head on. Because maybe that hasn't been their pattern of interacting in the past. In terms of risk and risk management, I don't think a lot of people have considered the risk in various decisions that they've made in the past. And so this process that I've described this morning, I suspect, is somewhat new to people. But as I mentioned, and you asked, John, is that there are some tools that we've tried to put together. There, for example, are some that address the statistics without needing to have a statistical background to actually use them. So again, we've tried to make these things practical for folks that are not academics, but that could be an area of getting hung up, is that people haven't thought about risk in the past and perhaps don't know how to measure it or evaluate it in terms of consequences for their own decision making. But probably a general answer to that question is that I don't think a lot of people actually follow a strategic process for managing their farm or ranch. In general, they have some goals in the back of mom and dad's minds, perhaps. They generally aren't shared very openly with the rest of the family, if it's a family operation, or certainly aren't shared very freely with employees. And I think that's where the biggest hurdle comes is people start wondering, well, why isn't everyone actually pulling toward the same end? And the reason is that they haven't really communicated that between themselves.
And Daryl, you ask a question about where you go on the web to view the archive programs. The address is here up on the screen now. And in just a minute, we're going to pull a a file sharing pod on that you can actually download, and it'll have these different web references in it. The other thing is simply to, on Google, to just Google Ag in Uncertain Times, and I think this website will come up. And there we have recordings of all of our webinars. We have the slide sets posted, listing of speakers with their contact information, so that if you want to contact with them. And there's also a discussion of the webinar topics. And John, I'll just, before we close down here, do you have some concluding thought you'd like to leave us with to get us ready for next week?
Well, again, I think if folks are interested in looking at a practical, pragmatic way of actually applying some of the strategic processing and steps that I discussed today, if you find that intriguing, I would just really encourage you to tune in next week, because the tools and so on, I think, are really the important part of having developed this text, because they allow someone to apply this process as opposed to just talking about it as a concept. I am personally most excited about the tools, and they really do cover the gamut of all of those 10 steps in a fairly thorough way. So again, thank you for the opportunity today, but that's what I would propose, is folks tune in next week, because we're going to try to cover as many as we can in 90 minutes.
This has been a very full webinar. I've personally, it's kept me intrigued and tied right in here, but it is time for us to say goodbye. And here's the file, and if you click on this file where it says Ag in Uncertain Times web links, underline November4th.pdf, and then go down and click on the Save to My Computer, highlight the file name, click on the Save to My Computer, and you can download this virus-free file directly to your computer, and it's got all of the web links right in that file for you to use. And another question, John, just before a couple have come in while I'm talking, and let me see if I can get up here. Well, we've answered interesting and seen more applications of the strategic planning process. Next week, you'll get an indication of that. That was one of the questions. And other questions, are there support groups we can attend? You got any thoughts on that, John?
My suggestion would be, if you're interested in more about what I've discussed this morning, that there are contact information at the Risk Navigator website, which you can, I would encourage you to contact one of us, one of the team members, because we have done several regional programs on this material in the past year, but we are also considering offering a number of programs into the future. So one of us could get back to you with some specifics about how and when we might be able to provide some additional support for yourself in terms of educating producers, or perhaps applying it in your own situation.
Thank you, John. Very, very good. And thank you for our audience for joining in with us today for what I hope you also felt was just very informative, interesting, in some cases captivating presentations. And invite you all to join us next Wednesday, again at the same time, which we think will be as interesting as we work through these tools and some really applied, useful information. So thank you, and we'll look forward to having you join us next Wednesday morning, 9 a.m. Pacific, 10 Mountain, 11 Central, 12 Eastern. Thank you.